From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. As a controversy over Australia government's plans to send all asylum seekers arriving by boat to Papua New Guinea for processing and resettlement continues, a whistleblower is making disturbing claims about life at the Manus Detention Center. Rod St. George was employed to work on Manus Island as part of the security team, but he resigned because he says he and his colleagues were powerless to prevent a culture of abuse among its inmates. He says at the time when he left, he knew of what he describes as one or two rape cases and the number of individuals who say they were vulnerable. Australia's Immigration Minister Tony Burke has asked to meet Mr. St. George, but as we hear from Aliza Harvey, Mr. Burke says he's still waiting for a response.
The Manus Island Detention Centre isn't a prison, but according to former centre worker turned whistleblower Rod St. George, it's worse.
I've never seen human beings so destitute, so helpless. In Australia, the facility couldn't even serve as a dog kennel. The owners would be jailed.
Mr. St. George resigned from his job at the private security company G4S earlier this year. He's told the Dateline program on SBS that he kept waiting for someone to come forward publicly, but when no one did, he felt he had to.
There was nothing that could be done for these young men who were considered vulnerable, which in many cases is just a euphemism for men who were being raped. It was obvious that everyone was way in over their head, that we did not have the facilities or the expertise to prevent what was happening. We might separate people in those circumstances on the mainland, but there aren't any facilities at Manus to do that.
In a statement to the ABC, the Department of Immigration says it's unaware of reports of rape at the centre. It says the welfare and safety of all people there is of utmost importance. Dateline interviewed Immigration Minister Tony Burke. He said he wanted the claims properly investigated and asked to speak to Mr. St. George directly, but nothing has happened since then.
What was put to me during that interview was deeply serious. I have wanted to act on it. I'm pretty concerned about the ethics of me having no opportunity for now an extended period of time to be able to follow up on specific allegations.
Greg Barnes from the Australian Lawyers Alliance thinks Mr. St. George is brave and says his claims are extremely concerning.
These centres are prisons. One of the great tragedies of the current system of mandatory detention is that unlike in the prison system where there is at least some form in various jurisdictions of oversight, whether it be by the Ombudsman or by the Inspector of Prisons, in this case there's really nothing. And these people are put into a position where they're detained for long periods of time. One shouldn't rely on the internal reporting of companies such as G4S or even the Commonwealth itself to ensure that they're safe. They're obviously not.
So far, Australia's tough new refugee policy is not deterring the number of teenage asylum seekers now in Indonesia. Underage asylum seekers who fled from Afghanistan and Pakistan by themselves say they are still trying to get to Australia by boat, regardless of the risks going on at PNG. George Roberts reports from Indonesia.
Water trickles through the picturesque paddy fields of Puncak south of Jakarta, where hundreds of villas are rented out to thousands of asylum seekers. One of them, a 16-year-old Hazara called Muhammad Hadi, is determined to get on a boat.
Whether they send us into PNG or no, today we are compelled to go there. We don't have money to, for ourselves, we don't have money here. Here we are compelled to go.
He shares a room with five others, including 17-year-old Bashar Ahmad and another 16-year-old called Naim. All three boys say their fathers were killed and their families sent them across the world to find safety. Naim is growing eager.
When will you go by boat?
As soon as possible. Yes, because now the Australian people, Australian government said that we send the people to PNG, and we want to go to there because we don't have any money to expend.
So you'd rather go to PNG than stay here?
Yes.
People smugglers have been offering free trips for anyone who can find enough paying customers. The boys think an Australian-operated detention centre beats being poor in Indonesia. They don't know anyone in Australia who can sponsor their asylum claim through the UNHCR and see no option. Bashar Ahmad is unconvinced they'll end up in PNG because nobody has been sent there since Kevin Rudd's announcement.
Somebody said that two ships arrived there, but they didn't send them on the PNG. Maybe they didn't send them to the PNG. As I have information, they said that most of the people of Australia didn't accept this policy, and also most of the parliament's people, until maybe that policy will be cancelled.
Another Hazara, a 32-year-old Muhammad Yunus, dreads the thought of waiting for years in Indonesia, along with the 10,340 other people hoping to get resettled.
I wanted to go, but right now nobody is able to take us. I called the people smuggler, but he told me to wait because of the rough seas.
Smugglers have been telling people they'll only spend a few months in Papua New Guinea. They can use history to support their sales pitch. Last month, the government began removing families from Manus Island, and the last children left early this month.
That was George Roberts reporting from Indonesia. Now for a story that we've reported on recently. Indian authorities say a school that served poison meals to children in the state of Bihar wasn't subjected to government checks on food preparation and storage. At least 22 children have died after eating a meal provided to them as part of a government program that gives free food to more than 120 million students across the country. For years, studies of the scheme have found problems with food handling and storage in schools across India, but little has been done to address the issue. Despite its problems, India's free school food program has increased enrollment at a primary level. Murali Krishna has more from India.
It is early morning and workers are busy at a kitchen in Vrindavan town in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh. They are preparing food for 165,000 students in over 1,600 schools across the district, rolling out 40,000 rotis, lentil curry and rice. Insulated and dust-free delivery vans are then used to ferry the cooked meals to schools in the districts. This grand scheme, which is perhaps the largest intervention against hunger, has had its share of problems. Like, for example, the tragic incident in the northern state of Bihar, where over 20 children died last week when traces of pesticide were found in their food. Otherwise, poor management and quality control of the midday meal scheme, as well as diversion of funds meant to feed poor children, are some of the other problems it faces. But even critics agree that if India's school enrollment rate has risen in the last few years, especially among girls, midday meal schemes deserve a share of the credit. Sunil Sharma is an administrator overseeing the distribution of food for children in a district in North India.
This is a big challenge to manage this scheme, because this is a very big and very scattered, and we have to manage it in a very good manner so that we can provide good quality and better meals to the students. This is helpful because in India there is a nutrition problem. Nutrition contents is also very low due to the poverty and lack of the food supply.
At a dilapidated government school building, school children are hard at work in the classrooms. Almost everyone has come to attend school on empty stomachs. Omveer Singh is a school principal. The government school boasts an attendance of over 100 students from class 3 to class 8. This scheme is a big blessing for children, especially the poor kids, who never get to eat a hot and healthy meal. They can only concentrate on their studies when they have nutritious food. And for many children, this is the only meal they have through the day. After the ritual prayer that normally precedes lunch, the students line up enthusiastically to pick up their plates and sit in neat rows for their sumptuous meal. Rajvati, a class 8 student whose father is a daily wage laborer, is happy.
I think it is good. For those who come hungry like me, this lunch is a blessing. I love the sweet dish at the end.
Suraj, another student, has been enjoying the scheme for the last 4 years.
The spices are less in these meals, and that makes it tasty. We never get to eat such food at home. And that's why this is a treat. This meal gives us energy and helps us concentrate.
That the program handles such volumes is itself a wonder. Teachers, despite odds, strive to feed children regularly. The scheme has also helped in a more modest way in tackling malnutrition. The latest UN Human Development Report states that 47% of Indian children under the age of 5 years are undernourished. Like in several crucial welfare schemes, the government is joined by private companies and NGOs. Akshay Patra is the Indian government's largest non-government partner, running 17 state-of-the-art kitchens across 8 states. Narsimha Dasa oversees the network in Uttar Pradesh.
When we started this program in the rural areas, we saw that the teachers would call the children and tell them, the upper caste students, please sit on this side, lower caste students, sit this side. That used to be the kind of thing. Over a period of time, what we have seen is now, the teachers call all the students and make all of them sit together and eat. All these caste barriers are being broken down. This is also an intangible but yet important contribution, I feel, of a midday meal program being served together for all the children at one time.
Besides being a vehicle for breaking down caste and community barriers, Mr. Dasa points out to other benefits.
We also did a third-party independent survey by an agency to study the impact of the classroom performance due to the midday meal. So there has been a marked improvement. There has been improvement in the attendance. There has been improvement in the enrollment.
Over the last decade, annual spending has increased from US $1.2 billion to $5 billion today. As with most of India's large state-run social schemes, the performance of the free meals program varies from state to state. The problems remain. But the real challenge in the country is how to deliver the program up to the last mile.
The next human pandemic could start in Asia, the Middle East, or Australia. But wherever the threat originates, the whole world will be at risk. As we hear from Karen Snowden, that's why researchers in Australia, Singapore, and the United States are joining forces in a $20 million collaboration aimed at preventing such a disaster.
The latest SARS-like virus, found originally in the Middle East, has killed more than 50% of those it's infected since late last year. It's spread to the UK, Germany, France, Italy, and Tunisia. The new H7N9 strain of bird flu has infected 134 people in China and killed 43, but no one knows how it's spread. The better-known H5N1 bird flu strain is of concern because it might mutate and cause a flu pandemic. Professor Linfa Wang, CSIRO's science leader, is a world expert on bat virology and the deadly Hendra virus in Australia.
Asia is one of the hot zones. So for Australians really want to be ready to fight any infectious disease, the best way, I always said, to fight the battle on somebody else's ground. So by partnering with Asia, we can use our expertise and our facility through collaboration so we can really train our team before the disease reaches Australia.
And how serious is the threat or risk of a human pandemic over the next few years?
I think we are getting very close. The risk is that it's always hard to say when, but I think definitely it will happen. All you need is a subtle change for the virus to be able to transmit between human to human, then it will spread to the world.
Hence, researchers from Australia, Singapore's National University and Duke University in the US are joining forces to help preempt the next human pandemic. With $20 million Australian dollars, the International Collaborative Centre for One Health has just been launched and will combine human, animal and wildlife health with environmental research. Dr. Gary Fitt, the director of the CSIRO's biosecurity flagship, says 70% of the emerging infectious diseases of humans are from animals and are unpredictable.
H7N9 avian influenza that's appeared in China really in the last few months and is, I guess, surprising and alarming people because it's a very unusual combination of components in a flu virus. It's something that's never been seen in humans before. It's a disease that has very high mortality in humans. It's killing a lot of people, of those that get it. We're lucky, though, that it doesn't yet have human-to-human transmission capabilities.
The new centre will draw on the expertise at Australia's Animal Health Laboratory in Geelong, the world's best high-containment facility. It will be headed by Linfa Wang, who also works closely with colleagues in China.
I always say that when you're fighting an infectious disease, it's like you're fighting a war. So the best preparation is to train your soldiers during peacetime so that you can really be ready during wartime. So that's what we're trying to achieve, is that this collaboration network is ready during peacetime. So if there is an outbreak or there is a war, then the soldiers on the ground will be ready.
Gary Fitt says invasive insect and plant pests are also on the radar of researchers.
Australia is now so connected to the globe that we need to be understanding where the risks might come from, what the pathways might be for those risks to impact on Australia, and what science we need to put in place to block those pathways, preempt those risks if we can.
American Vice President Joe Biden embarked on a four-day official visit to India, aimed at boosting the two countries' fledgling trade and security relationship. The trip is the highest level since U.S. President Barack Obama visited the country in 2010. Kanaha Sapati has more.
U.S.-India relations have achieved a level of stability where both countries have agreed to work together closely on a number of common issues. So, in his talks with Indian leaders and the business community, U.S. Vice President Joe Biden will focus on trade and security concerns. Among the economic concerns are U.S. frustrations with what they see as unfair trading practices, the need for stronger intellectual property protection, and India's championing of generic drugs. Dr. Amitendu Palit, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore, says India's reluctance and delay in instituting key economic reforms are adding to the frustrations.
US looks at India as a major market for a lot of its producers, particularly the service industries of the US. And there would be talks between Mr. Biden and his Indian counterparts on how business between the two countries can actually be stepped up to a higher level. And that would essentially relate around the areas on which the two countries have been talking to each other for a long time. But these are issues which are not very difficult to sort of handle if there is an agreement on both sides, that both sides need to look at each other's point of views.
One issue that will need maturity and understanding on both sides is the now stalled deal for U.S. investment in Indian nuclear energy projects. U.S. investors are not prepared to enter into the Indian market until energy producers are given assurance that they would not be held liable in the event of a nuclear fallout, something that India is not prepared to give, given the experience of the 1982 Bhopal gas tragedy. Dr. Palit again.
Both countries need to figure out a way of handling this issue because India clearly needs investments for nuclear power. On the other hand, there is this larger domestic concern which needs to be addressed. So I think the maturity on part of both sides would actually come in through the acceptance that there are difficulties on both sides. But having accepted those, there has to be a middle path which has to be struck on this and has to be taken forward.
On the security front, both countries have common concerns as to what happens post-foreign troop withdrawal from Afghanistan next year and the rise of China. India has always wanted a strategic role in Afghanistan, but until last year when U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta visited India, this was blocked by Washington. Dr. Sandy Gordon, a visiting fellow at the College of Asia and Pacific at the Australian National University, explains why.
I think the U.S. was initially a little bit skeptical about this because they thought that that might provoke Pakistan into taking a stronger line in support of the Taliban once NATO had wound down. But when Leon Panetta went to New Delhi, the U.S. seemed to be a little bit more comfortable with that sort of role for India.
Dr. Palit believes Mr. Biden's talks with Indian officials will also deal with the common fear of terrorism in the subcontinent post-2014.
I think the concern is that whether Afghanistan, Pakistan and the rest of the countries in the region do again become victims of terrorist initiatives in a rather loose and undefined manner, so much so that spreads on to India as well, and whether that in a sense gets to affect the U.S. also in the longer term.
The rise of China and the realignment of the U.S. security pivot to Asia will also be up for discussion. In the last 10 years, India has bought U.S. defense equipment to the tune of $8 billion, and more is in the pipeline. And while both sides would not want China to see their cooperation as a containment policy, Dr. Gordon says security cooperation with India is vital for Washington.
I think the U.S. goal is to build India up strategically through the transfer of technology so that you have a more diffused power arrangement. So you have what we call a multipolar balance.
Leaders in the Pacific gathered on Solomon Islands in the capital, Honiara, for the 10th anniversary of the Regional Assistance Mission to Solomon Islands, or RAMSI. and the withdrawal of its last military contingent. It's the first in 3 years of official ceremonies and events that included a look at what the mission has achieved since it arrived in 2003 and discussions on its role in the future. Ramsey Special Coordinator Nicholas Chappell presented the people of Solomon Islands with artworks depicting the history of the mission. Cora Hawkins, the correspondent for this program in Solomon Islands, caught up with him and the Speaker of the Parliament, Sir Alan Kameza, who signed the agreement that started the process in 2003 when he was Prime Minister.
Well, the celebration is both Ramsey and Solomon Islands. It's about 10 years after Ramsey first arrived, and the achievements have been happened since then. But those achievements are a product of both Ramsey's assistance, but also the receptiveness of the Solomon Islands government, the range of reforms which the Solomon Islands government has introduced. So the partnership that we have is what's being celebrated the last 10 years. But we've come a long way from the country that was on the brink of failure, as many people characterised it in 2003, where a government was defaulting on debt, unable to repay and meet its obligations, where the government was not in a position to control the streets of Honiara, where there was a lot of people using firearms and with menace, moving into government departments, demanding payments, extorting the customary system of compensation. The country was really in a very difficult situation. School teachers, public servants were not being paid. And today we have a country where law and order rules, where we have virtually no firearm-related crime, where the government has a balanced budget, a fully funded budget, an economy growing, people are free to go about their business, about whether it be work or to education for the children. So there's a lot to celebrate in 10 years, and we're happy to be a part of that.
Exit is a word that we're always hearing, no matter how many times we tell people that it's not an exit. What is the message for the Solomon Island people this 10th anniversary?
Ramsey has been going through a period of change for quite some time. Indeed, since the day it arrived, it's been going through a period of change. The most marked change has been in the way assistance has been delivered. In the early days, many public servants came up from Australia and were working in Solomon Islands government ministries, doing the work that needed to be done to get the government back in functioning. Now, we stepped back from that. We changed the way we were delivering assistance quite some time ago, with a focus much more on providing capacity building, raising the skills levels of public servants, Solomon Island public servants, so that they could do those jobs. So we've reduced the number of people we call in line and have increased the numbers of advisors. But even the advisor numbers have come down quite a bit. So because it's been through this period of change, we've used the word transition rather than exit. And the most significant changes have happened this year. And that is with the remainder of our aid program. That's now moved across to the Australian High Commission to be managed by AusAid, as part of their programme of assistance. And also the military component of Ramsey has stood down from duties and will be leaving in the next few weeks. Ramsey will then be a policing-only mission, a very large policing mission, but also the work that the police are doing is different from what it was at the beginning. At the beginning, Ramsey police were patrolling streets, they were making arrests, they were prosecuting, they were bringing directly hands-on justice into the Solomon Islands. Today, Ramsey's police, their focus is very much on building up the capabilities of the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force. And so that's why the word transition is a much better one than exit.
10th anniversary, Blo Ramsey. How important is this occasion for Solomon Islands? And maybe looking back at the history, where are we now?
First of all, I have to thank the founders of the Bekie Tawa Declaration, especially the forum leaders, to make that vehicle available for any of the member countries to use whenever we caught up into the same situation at Solomon Islands have done. As far as I know, it is a great challenge for our country and the people, because we made this tension and we created ourselves, but we found it very difficult to settle it or take those two warring parties in a negotiation table. Lucky that we used to make it our declaration, and also Australia and New Zealand put in their taxpayers' money and participating countries to deal, to ensure that our country rebuild back after this tension. What I would say also, I was thank the two warring parties for their understanding, and I thank the people of Solomon Islands for their cooperation. Without the cooperation, this 10 years would not successful as it is now today. So the country is now on its foot. The economy is grow. Let us continue on from here. The challenge for us in the Solomon Islands is we have to work together with the determination and go forward to where Ramsi perhaps will finally leave us. It's not easy, but we can do it.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program or would like to hear updates on stories that we've done, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. Next week on the show, we're taking a little bit of a vacation, so we're presenting a best of show, so do tune into that. Also, a quick reminder that you can hear another edition of the show on Sundays at 1330 UTC, that's 1330 UTC, on 11835 kHz. That's targeting listeners in Southeast and East Asia at 1330 UTC. And that program is presented by Andy Sennett. If you want to listen to this program again or past editions of the show, you can visit our website at any time you want. Yeah, it's very easy. Just go to www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. And while you're there, there is a link so you can download the programs directly into iTunes, as well as information on how you can subscribe free of charge to Stitcher Smart Radio and be able to have the program on your iPhone or Android phone or your iPad or whatever other smart device you're using. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Parent wishing you well, hoping that you have a great weekend. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Take care and see you soon.